From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Lawmakers in both the House and Senate will return to Washington early next week, which means we will soon learn more about what will happen with the impeachment trial. Meanwhile, Washington is digesting the sad news that Congressman John Lewis, a giant of the civil rights movement, is battling stage 4 pancreatic cancer. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving is with us. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
So we spoke last week about Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski, who said she was disturbed that Majority Leader Mitch McConnell vowed to coordinate with the White House in the upcoming impeachment trial. Murkowski is one of several Republican senators that could support having witnesses in that trial, something that Democrats want. Here is Senator Chris Van Hollen, a Democrat, speaking with ABC's This Week.
A fair trial means you get to call your witnesses, and Senator Murkowski put her finger on the big issue, right? Is Senator McConnell, the Republican leader, going to try to rig this trial right from the start, working in lockstep with the president and his lawyers, or is he going to allow a fair trial?
Ron, have we heard anything more about whether there will be witnesses, and could one of those witnesses be Joe Biden?
Nothing official. There have probably been communications through staff and intermediaries, but no word of a personal meeting between the leaders or between McConnell and Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, and that may be more where the rub is. Let's talk a little bit about Biden. He had said, no, I'm not going to testify. If they call me, I'm going to refuse the subpoena. Then apparently over the weekend, realizing that's probably not a good look for him to be talking about defying a subpoena when that's kind of what the president's being accused of. He said, well, if there's a good, valid subpoena, I would show up and testify. But his resistance here is based in his reluctance to allow the Republicans to change the subject from what the president did that he was impeached for. And let's change the subject to what the Bidens did in Ukraine. That would certainly be the purpose of bringing him in as a witness.
Now, you said there's been no meeting between McConnell and Pelosi. She has not sent the articles of impeachment to the Senate yet, which could delay a trial. Republicans have derided Pelosi for this. Here's Representative Steve Scalise, Republican on Fox News Sunday.
Maybe she's trying to carry out her own quid pro quo by acting as if she's got some kind of role in the Senate trial. They had a weak case. I think she knows they had a weak case. There was no evidence and no crime committed. And yet they still wanted to impeach the president to appease their radical base.
Ron, what is your sense of when Pelosi will send the articles over to the Senate?
My sense is that this delay isn't necessarily significant, at least not yet. First, there was never a chance that the Senate was going to start a trial before Christmas or immediately after or even before New Year's. So the soonest it was ever going to start in the Senate was the first or second week of January. So whatever delay we're likely to see probably won't amount to that much, maybe an extra week. If that, maybe an extra 2 weeks. This is not a long-term strategy. This was about keeping the center of attention on impeachment through the holidays.
Okay, let's talk about John Lewis, civil rights icon, longtime Democratic representative who announced that he has the most advanced stage of pancreatic cancer. What else do we know about this?
We know that John Lewis will be 80 on his next birthday in February. This is a tough diagnosis for anyone at any age. Pancreatic cancer has long been among the deadliest cancers, but we also know there are new treatments that have been showing real promise in treating this disease, and we know also that John Lewis has been a fighter and a survivor for a long time as well. On his announcement last night, he included a vow to fight this latest battle with all the determination he's brought to other battles throughout his life.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Ron. The Washington Post is reporting today that President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, called the president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, in September of 2018. This is the same Maduro who's been described by the Trump administration as a murderous dictator who supports terrorism. So Giuliani called him in September of 2018 to try to negotiate an exit, which would be another example of Giuliani operating shadow diplomacy for the White House. What does this tell you?
One thing we're wondering is what he might have been offering Maduro to get him out. But look, it confirms the suspicion that Giuliani has been operating as some kind of side door secretary of state or back door national security advisor for some time. And he's doing it around the world and he's doing it below the radar. And it ought to be disturbing, first of all, to the individuals who actually have those jobs, the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor. They have the official responsibility to actually perform these tasks officially, when Rudy Giuliani's running around performing them unofficially on behalf of the president. It also raises real questions as to what the real U.S. foreign policy is in these and other critical areas of the world. In the Venezuela case, it looks like Giuliani may have been on roughly the same page as the rest of the Trump administration, but in Ukraine, that was clearly not the case. And how many other cases of rogue diplomacy are out there waiting still to be discovered?
That is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thanks so much and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Jeremy.
Well, staying with politics and scanning the horizon, on February 11th, Democrats in New Hampshire go to the polls in the presidential primaries with one of the largest candidate fields in generations, and they're looking for ways to keep up with platforms and policy proposals. But of course, voters of all stripes can find it hard to navigate those shoals. And as New Hampshire Public Radio's Daniela Alley reports, some are recalibrating the way they consume news as they prepare for the primary.
Chicken chile rellenos and fajitas helped get three friends through a debate watch party at a Mexican restaurant in Lebanon, New Hampshire. Minda Gowardy and husband and wife Malcolm Shangala and Kelly Corbett watched intently. They've been friends for 10 years, and they all pay attention to the news. So, naturally, politics comes up pretty frequently. For a long time, Shangala used the Google News app to find out what was happening.
It was easy to get news from sources across the political spectrum. Right-wing stuff, left-wing stuff, moderate stuff, it was right there.
But by the morning of the debate, he'd had enough. He deleted the app from his phone. He and his wife had noticed he was increasingly short-tempered after reading the news.
Well, I've just read, you know, a bunch of articles from dueling political spectrum news sources. And now I'm stuck in, this crossfire of angry politics.
So Shangala switched. He goes to the source now, scouring websites from Fox, CNN, The New York Times. And that allows him to curate his media diet more carefully. The Google News app algorithm, he says, just seemed designed to get him to click on the most provocative headlines.
Suspicion is that it was trying to find articles that just generated clicks as much as possible, and that seemed to be synonymous with provoking outrage.
Minda Gowardy also works to add variety to her news feed. She knows she's drawn to stories that confirm what she's already thinking.
My gut reaction when I think about a policy is to sort of default left. Right. If I hear something on the left, I'm like, yes, of course. Right. Left.
To be a more informed voter, she says, she makes a point of reading things she might disagree with.
I think it forces me to think a little bit more and to say, wait, what is the other side? What is more well-rounded? Where is this coming from?
Unlike Gowardy and Shangala, it's hard for Kelly Corbett to read other news sources.
My blood boils too much when I'm reading right-wing stories.
But she does have someone she can rely on to tell her what the other side is saying. Her husband reads news from across the political spectrum.
So I rely on him to kind of like give me the synopsis. What are they actually saying on the other side of the aisle?
Changing up news sources is one approach. Other folks are growing more skeptical about ones they used to rely on.
My name is Miriam Osofsky, and I am a clinical psychologist.
Osofsky's politically active. Climate change is her issue. She says the last few election cycles have left her feeling that the media is no longer an impartial moderator of the political debate. She points to how, in her view, much of the press failed to take Bernie Sanders' campaign seriously in 2016.
And I became more skeptical and more careful about how I interpreted what I read.
Osofsky doesn't really trust mainstream media, so she looks for news sources that are funded entirely by subscribers, like Democracy Now!, a left-leaning radio and TV show.
Mainstream media has an agenda. They're very wealthy people who benefit from things as they are. The oligarchy want them to stay that way.
But Osofsky still has a subscription to the New York Times and reads it most days, but selectively now. She devours the paper's climate coverage, but takes a pass on its opinion page. Corey Harai, who lives in Lebanon, is taking a different tact altogether. She's trying to be a news source herself, using her social media accounts. When she lived in the Midwest for 10 years, Harai had a very different primary experience and missed New Hampshire's retail politics.
I would have to like rely on my friends in New Hampshire to like tell me what was going on. And so when I moved back to New Hampshire, I was like, okay, this is my job now. I am going to be everybody else's source of information because I am going to meet all the candidates.
So far, Harai's met 9 of the Democratic candidates. She's created a Facebook album for the upcoming primary so her friends can flip through her posts easily. Each one includes a selfie with a brief analysis about the candidate.
They should know enough to not know that it's not the definitive evaluation of the candidate, but it is a different perspective than what they're going to be able to get through any other sort of media.
Harai says she takes this seriously. She feels she's reporting and telling stories that her friends back in the Midwest can't get in local or national media. She says she's not trying to influence how they vote, but she does want as many people as possible to see what she posts. So she's learned some tricks on Facebook. Post selfies, reply to comments. And in that way, she's not that different from news outlets. She wants her stories to be read. For Hearing Now, I'm Daniela Alley.
As 2019 draws to a close, we thought we'd take a look at the year in film with our longtime friend Ty Burr, film critic of the Boston Globe. Ty, great to speak with you as always every year around this time.
Thank you. Great to be back.
And just give us an overall impression of the year.
Honestly, it was a pretty good year for movies. I mean, both at the blockbuster level, you had, a couple of major franchises coming to an end successfully. And I think also at the level of films made by people, about people, for people. And I really do think that the streaming revolution is at least currently helping filmmaking by bankrolling and by offering money and space for different kinds of voices, different kinds of storytellers. And I think we're seeing the result of that on screens.
You have a list for us, the best of the year. What jumped out at us is that the number one film is not the film about a marriage gone south, which we will talk about and everyone is talking about. The number one film is a film that maybe people haven't even heard of, a French film called Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Yes, this is a movie that actually premiered at the Cannes Film Festival back in May. I saw it first at the Toronto Film Festival in September. It has gotten a token North American release. It has been in theaters, and it is getting awards from critics groups and stuff, but it won't actually be released to many, many theaters until February of 2020.
Here in the States.
Yeah.
But it's had a huge buzz in 2019, if you were in the know. Just give me a brief thumbnail. Why do you like it?
It is directed by a woman named Céline Sciamma, a French director. Her last movie was Girlhood, which was terrific. It's set in the early 18th century about a woman painter who goes to a distant part of Brittany in France to paint the portrait on commission of a young woman who is engaged to be married to a man she hasn't met.
We have read about 90 articles about this film in the New York Times.
Okay.
I mean, this is the film that, you're right, it's getting a lot of attention.
It is beautiful. It's very stately. It's very austere. And then it blossoms into just amazing sensuality. And I'm not just talking about sex sensuality. I'm talking about just emotional, visual sensuality as the relationship between these two women sort of changes from subterfuge. At first, the painter isn't even telling her subject she's a painter. She's just making friends with her. And then slowly their bond grows. And one of the things I love about the movie is that it kind of works on both the ideal level and the dramatic level equally. It's about women being looked at, but also turning that around and looking.
I cannot wait.
And
cannot
it is
wait.
Just gorgeous to look at.
Okay. Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Can't wait to see that. But everybody has been flocking to see your number two, Marriage Story.
Yes.
Of course, this is Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson, a couple whose marriage is falling apart. Let's listen to a scene.
You turned down the residency at the Geffen that would have brought us here for a year.
It wasn't something I wanted. We had a great theater company and a great life where we were.
You call that a great life?
You know what I mean. I don't mean we had a great marriage. I mean life in Brooklyn. Professionally. I don't know. Honestly, I never considered anything different.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, I was your wife. You should have considered my happiness, too.
Come on. You were happy. You've just decided you weren't now.
So, Ty Burr, at this point, we have to mention, yes, we know that Adam Driver walked out of an interview with Terry Gross on Fresh Air because of something they played that he didn't want to hear.
His own voice.
But we saw him in Burn This on Broadway also, which was another, a character that became very volatile.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about your sense of this film.
Well, the sense of this film for me isn't about his volatility. It's about the averageness of these two people or the relatability. And of course, I say this as an upper middle class white guy in America, which is what Noah Baumbach is and who he's writing about.
That's the writer-director. Yeah.
Yeah. He roots a lot of the stories in aspects of his own life. And he did get divorced from an actress, Jennifer Jason Leigh. But one of the things I love about this movie is that these two people aren't enemies. They are friends who can no longer live together. And it's actually about their attempts to not have it turn toxic, yet there's no way it can't, because this is what happens when two people who have been knit together in life have to pull themselves apart. And the other thing I love about this movie is just the gallery of supporting actors around them. Julie Haggerty, Alan Alda, Ray Liotta, Laura Dern, who's just terrific as a divorce attorney. I've been a fan of Noah Baumbach for years. He's blown hot and cold. But this, to me, is a breakthrough for him in that it really, even though it's about a very particular social class and group of people, it does feel universal.
All right. And by the way, we'll have Ty's list at herenow.org. Third on the list is the Korean film Parasite. But we also want to talk about Knives Out, the story of a family whose patriarch has died. It looks like a clear-cut case of suicide. Then a private detective shows up. And here's a scene with Jamie Lee Curtis as one of the daughters and Daniel Craig as that detective.
Why are you here?
I'm here at the behest of a client.
Who?
I cannot say, but let me assure you this. My presence will be ornamental. You will find me a respectful, quiet, passive observer of the truth.
I just love Daniel Craig in this movie. He is just having so much fun with that foghorn leghorn accent.
Foghorn.
This is here because it is, you know how people say they don't make them like they used to? Well, here's a movie that is the way they used to make movies that is just absolutely entertaining, brilliantly crafted, lots of fun, smart dialogue, smart performances. It's a murder mystery that sort of riffs on all those Clue, Agatha Christie, you know, Death Trap movies and books that we've read. But it's very smart about it, gives you a mystery, makes sure that it plays fair by the ending, gives you one character to root for and a lot of characters you kind of enjoy not rooting for. And it's just so much fun. So when people ask me, as they are now at this time of year, hey, what do I go see over the holidays? And I know that they may not want to see, you know, a austere French drama or a grueling marriage, you know, story about divorce. Go see Knives Out.
Yeah,
it is just so much fun.
It's just about a potential suicide.
Not really.
Yeah, right.
Not really.
Exactly. Okay, so Knives Out is in theaters now, as is another film on your list. It just opened, Greta Gerwig's Little Women, which stars Saoirse Ronan as Jo March, the would-be author and tomboy of Louisa May Alcott's much-loved novel, Little Women. Let's listen to a little of a scene with her.
I just feel like women, they have minds and they have souls as well as just hearts, and they've got ambition and they've got talent as well as just beauty. And I'm so sick of people saying that love is just all a woman is fit for. I'm so sick of it.
So are we, Joe. She was always my favorite. I was a Joe girl. But here you are, a guy.
Yes.
And so?
I can't enjoy this movie?
Yes, you can. How did you?
Honestly, I don't think you can make a bad version of this book. I mean, I love the 1933 version with Katharine Hepburn. I love the 1990s version with Winona Ryder. Greta Gerwig actually takes some interesting chances here. She sort of breaks open the chronology of the narrative and has some flashbacks and flash forwards. She kind of stiffens its spine, and she doesn't modernize it or turn the language into sort of modern feminist language, but she puts sentiments in the mouth of her characters and in the language of her characters that do just emphasize an aspect that's already there in the book in a way that's really smart and really quite emotional. And one of the things I like about this movie, I think Saoirse Ronan is fine. She's great. She's always great. This is the first Little Women I've seen that's almost stolen by its Amy. It was played by Florence Pugh. And Amy is usually played as a spoiled brat, and you kind of hate her. And Gerwig and Pugh have kind of recast her as a character who is a little spoiled and a little bratty, but who matures and who grows into, like her sister, a creative womanhood, but is also stymied in certain ways. Yeah. And Pugh gives a really, really fully felt performance that takes nothing away from Ronan in the lead.
Okay. And by the way, your opinion, is Greta Gerwig getting overlooked in some of the early honors categories?
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
I think I think it's partly because she's an actress and a well-known face and I don't think people necessarily trust that as a director unless it's a guy.
Yeah, unless it's a guy. Okay. Just want to mention a documentary that came out this summer that you also are noting as one of the best films of 2019. And I remember reading ones about Honeyland. That it actually started as some sort of a government educational film or something.
Right.
But it's spectacular.
And the two women who filmed it went to this rural part of Macedonia, found this woman who's middle-aged, beekeeper, and kind of a natural beekeeper. She finds hives in the sides of mountains, and but also has her own little hives at her tumble-down shack. And they started filming her, and then this family moves in next door, and it really becomes a dramatic narrative just unfolding as you're watching. And they stuck around for 3 years and created this movie that—
Because the family doesn't want the bees.
Well, the family doesn't want the bees, but then the dad realizes, hey, she's making money off the bees. I can make money off the bees. But the way he goes about it says a lot in a very unforced metaphorical way about the way you can live with nature or the way you can use it up. Again, it never overplays its hand. It just dramatizes it in real life through these people.
Okay, another to add to the list. And the whole list will be at herenow.org. Ty Burr has made his picks for the year. We'd love to hear yours as well at hereandnow.org because we know we left a lot out. And by the way, you have another column, the best films of the entire past decade. Just give us two.
Mad Max Fury Road. Mm-hmm. Maybe one of the best action movies ever made.
Okay.
And Phantom Thread.
Phantom Thread.
The Paul Thomas Anderson movie with Daniel Day-Lewis that is about a very twisted love story that's, in my mind, one of the sneakiest comedies about love ever made.
Okay. Well, so listeners, we'll link you to that column as well, and let's hear your votes. Best films of the entire past 10 years. Let us know herenow.org. Ty, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
You may have gotten a Google Home or Amazon Echo as a holiday gift. One in four Americans now owns a smart speaker, and they're giving artificial intelligence like Amazon's Alexa more control over their homes, from light bulbs to door locks, which raises the question, how easily can those speakers be hacked? KUOW's Joshua McNichols looked into how hackers can get around the Amazon Echo's defenses, and we note that Amazon is one of NPR's sponsors.
The Amazon Echo is like a fortress to a hacker. The plastic case and the circuit board inside are its stone walls. The firmware that runs it, that's the soldiers on the ramparts. But fortresses are just asking to be breached, and hackers can't leave them alone. Now, there are two ways to attack a fortress. You can storm the gates, like in this Game of Thrones episode, or you can sneak in through the sewers. We tried both ways.
Okay, so
who's got a steady hand?
First, we stormed the fortress walls. I went to a hardware hacker meetup in Seattle, and Kyle Pellet and Brady Klockinga used screwdrivers, soldering irons, and a Linux laptop to try to see the code inside my Echo so they could control it. Ben Kurtz, the instructor here, was like a general telling the troops what to do.
You want to dump the firmware, reverse engineer it, and then figure out how you can attack similar units without having to take them apart.
The hackers took apart but could not take over the device. That's because Amazon keeps improving the Echo's defenses. When someone discovers a crack in the wall, Amazon patches it. But from Game of Thrones, you may know that that's not the best way to breach fortress walls. So I enlisted the cybersecurity firm InfoSec to try a different approach. A hacker there named Cameron Bolanda sent me a phishing email that tricked me into giving up my Amazon password. This was like me showing him where the sewer pipes come out so he can get inside the fortress.
Right now, we're taking a look at all their devices.
Next, he took control of the electronics in my house.
Let's drop in.
Early one morning, he logged into an Echo Show's camera in my home and snooped on us as we ate breakfast in the living room.
And there he is with his daughter.
Then he started to make stuff happen. Lights flashed on and off.
Whoa, the piano light turned off.
Oh.
Our stereo system started playing songs.
And I was playing a bunch of weird music.
We thought it was funny. But later we found out he also learned my home address, where I buy groceries, my wife's telephone number, my mother's telephone number, and what's on my to-do list, all through the Alexa account. Using that kind of info, a hacker could burrow deeper into my private and financial life by crafting even more effective phishing emails. Damian Hess is the director of digital security at Amazon. He said Amazon has built some of the best defenses in the industry to keep out hackers.
Because it has multiple layers. So if you peel one layer of security, boom, there's another one there that holds you back.
But we, the users, remain the weakest part in Amazon's defense system. All the security in the world can't protect us from ourselves. Amazon advises us to be careful and points out some useful weapons for defending fortress walls. We can turn on two-factor authentication and hover over links in emails to see if the URL looks suspicious. But there's another way to protect ourselves that Amazon doesn't like to talk about. Avoid smart home products altogether. Because if you don't build a fortress, there's less to attack. For Here and Now, I'm Joshua McNichols.
The U.S. military carried out airstrikes in Somalia yesterday. The strikes targeted al-Shabaab militants, which the country's president blames for a huge truck bomb that killed at least 78 people in the capital Mogadishu on Saturday. Al-Shabaab has links to al-Qaeda. Joining us now is BBC Africa editor Will Ross. He's in London. Will, is there any reason to believe this wasn't an al-Shabaab attack?
Well, most of the evidence points to yet another attack by al-Shabaab. You've got to bear in mind the history of this group carrying out frequent bombings, especially in the capital Mogadishu. And it's quite rare that they don't own up to it and say, this was one that we did. But a possible reason for that might be the sheer number of civilians that were killed on this occasion, because when there was another vast truck bomb attack in 2017, there was no claim on that one either. Mm. And people are of the opinion that that al-Shabaab would perhaps lose support if they owned up to what clearly has been the killing of innocents. Having said all that, the Somali authorities are trying to point the blame at an outside country, and they're not naming that country, but they're suggesting there's been some foreign influence. And of course, Somalia is kind of tied up in the Gulf rivalry between different countries. So they're suggesting that an outside country has had some role in this. But I think most people in Somalia and most people who are watching what's going on in the country would believe this was yet another al-Shabaab attack.
Well, if it is al-Shabaab, what is it that they want? How much territory do they control there in Somalia?
Well, they are still a powerful force, especially in the remote areas. And what goes on now is they actually operate pretty much as a parallel government in some of those rural areas where they collect taxes. And even in parts of the capital, Mogadishu, where, you know, officially they're not in power, they can still extort, in effect, money from businesses. So they still have quite a lot of power. And it's quite clear that the authorities don't have the capacity, despite the international support, they don't have the capacity to kind of make the whole country safe.
What does it tell you that the U.S. responded here with airstrikes against al-Shabaab?
That's happened quite a lot over the last few months. And in fact, under the presidency of Donald Trump, those airstrikes have gone up significantly. Mm. Going back to April, AFRICOM said it had killed more than 800 people in 110 airstrikes since April 2017. But there are some concerns. Human rights groups like Amnesty International have said that quite often during these airstrike attacks, civilians are killed. even though the usual line from the Somali government and from the US military is that, you know, these were successful airstrikes and jihadists were killed. And even on this occasion, although it's, you know, very hard for us to independently verify any of this, but on al-Shabaab's own radio station, they're saying that a civilian was killed and livestock were hit and a dozen camels were killed. Whether that's just an attempt to dismiss the US statement or not is hard to say, but certainly there have been some concerns. And on occasion, the US military has admitted, admitted civilian deaths.
That is the BBC's Africa editor, Will Ross, speaking with us from London. Will, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, shifting gears now, the rock band Coldplay recently announced it will pause touring for environmental reasons. Here's frontman Chris Martin speaking with the BBC.
We're taking time over the next year or two to work out how can not only our tour be sustainable, but how can it be actively beneficial.
The British band Massive Attack is also thinking about this. The group has teamed up with the University of Manchester's Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research to look at how to limit carbon emissions on tour. Joining us now is the centre's director, Carly McLaughlin. Carly, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, how much of a negative impact are musicians having on the environment when they go on tour?
Well, obviously, there's different elements that are all resulting in carbon emissions. So the things that we're looking at in our work are around the travel for the band, their staff and their gear, the emissions that come from consuming energy at the venue, and then also the emissions associated with audience travel. There's obviously lots of other areas as well around the kinds of things that are consumed at venues, but we're focusing on those three areas in our study.
So in that case, is the band kind of irrelevant because it's just about a bunch of people traveling from place to place?
Do you mean, are the band's emissions irrelevant?
No, I mean, it could be anything. It could be a traveling theatrical production. It could be a political convention.
Yeah, anything that generates lots of travel. I suppose the additional thing, particularly with music or with anything from kind of arts and culture, is that they also have this communication with their audience. And by doing something around trying to tackle climate change, they potentially send a kind of a larger signal. Also, these high profile bands can help to catalyse change across the industry potentially. So they have more power to be able to say what they would like from the people that book them, from the mm-hmm. venues, how they'd like their tours to be managed. And so actually then you could see that trickling through so that the impact for smaller bands who perhaps feel that they kind of have to accept the conditions that are offered to them would play through as well.
So what was your reaction when the band Massive Attack reached out to you about this?
Well, I mean, we were absolutely delighted. They know the kind of impact they're having. One of the reasons they came to us was that they had looked at offsetting the emissions from their tour. But actually, because they looked into it and they understand the sort of urgency of the need to tackle climate change, they came to the conclusion that it wasn't the best way to tackle it. And actually, what they should do is look much more thoroughly at really trying to drive down the emissions from their tours rather than just calculating it and offsetting it.
So how could a band do that, drive down the emissions from their tours?
So, I mean, we haven't done the work yet. So with that caveat in place that our findings might be different from kind of some of the ideas we have going in, it's back to those three areas that we're looking at. So there's the travel of the band and crew, thinking about the logistics and the ordering of how you do a tour. So at the moment, we know that often people are flying between venues. They might come back to a city and play it again, or they might go to one country, then another, and then back to the original country. So could we actually learn more from the sort of logistics industry there and thinking about how we order that sort of stuff? In terms of venues themselves, they can be looking at being much more efficient in the energy that they consume, the types of set and lighting and things that they use. And then you've got audience travel as well. So how are your audience getting to the venue and could you reduce the emissions of that? And they have a really lovely phrase, Massive Attack, that they talk about positively disrupting. And I think that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to work with the sector to say, how could things be different to try and reduce the impact?
Do you think that the end result of this could be that fans end up having to pay even more to go see a show? And as you know, they can be pretty expensive even now.
I don't think that's where we're heading. And I mean, one of the things with the music industry, because there's lots of pressures on how tours get booked, I think there's the potential for lots of what we would call low-hanging fruit, so like quite easy options to reduce emissions. Now, you might actually find that some of these measures save money for people in the industry rather than it costing more. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to look at the detail of that to know, but we're certainly not going into it thinking, well, you know, we need to put more money on ticket prices and that will sort it all out. It's really much more about the practices in the sector and trying to open those up a little bit.
Now, you're starting your research, but how urgent is this problem? Are you do you get concerned just in the meantime every time you see a concert of a band on tour that they are causing problems for the environment?
I mean, I think the way that the world currently is set up, I wouldn't single the music industry out. I think we all have to look at the sectors that we're in and how we could try and positively disrupt those to reduce the emissions. But in a broader sense, climate change is absolutely an urgent issue. And whereas we have tended to talk about climate change as, you know, getting to, you know, really low emissions by 2050 or people talking about 2100 and things like that, it's much more about the emissions in the short term. So people sometimes call it the decisive decade that we're now in, that this is where we have to really turn emissions round to get onto the right kind of pathway to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. So don't think of this as something that your kids are going to sort out. You have to sort it out now for your kids.
That is Carly McLaughlin, who is director at the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research at the University of Manchester in the UK, looking at the carbon impact of bands that are on tour. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If your inbox has been filling with messages informing you of updates to privacy policies, it's probably because of the new California Consumer Privacy Act, which takes effect Wednesday, January 1st, first day of the year. It's being called the strictest digital privacy law in the U.S. It requires tech companies, most of which are based in California, to disclose what data they collect on users and what they're doing with it, and requires them to give users the option to opt out of having their data sold. Sarah Morrison is a reporter for Recode. She's been looking into the implications of this new law as part of Vox's open-sourced reporting initiative. And Sarah, we already know that sites like Google and Facebook are tracking us, for instance, how we shop. And we'll get this email notifying us of the new law. But how will we actually see the change in the options?
I think the way that most people will see this is you go to a website and, you know, just like you said, there's the emails with all the new privacy policies that will inform you. I think the websites will have to have some language on them, I think in the footer or somewhere on it, and then also a do not sell my information link. And that is where you would go to then opt out. The privacy policies also have to spell certain things out more than they might already, and then also give you links or ways that you can opt out of having your data sold.
No. Well, step back. Do you think there's going to be any surprises here? You know, we all kind of know that, let's say, you know, if we are going to buy something, the people will be alerted that we're about to buy something and maybe try to sell us something else. But do you think there's going to be something that will surprise us about how we use the internet and how that data is used?
I think the surprises will come if you exercise the option of asking a company to give you the data that it's collected about you, which Californians can do. I think if you're not a Californian, you can ask. They don't have to do it, but I don't know how many of them are going to really take the time to figure out if you're a Californian or not and might just give it to you. So I think the surprises there will be they have to tell you what they've collected, I think how they got it, and I think be specific about what they've collected from you. And I think that might be surprising to people to see how specific, how much knowledge that a website might have about them.
Do you think it's going to be more than, you know, people shopping? Because, you know, again, we get that. We know that, you know, people might sell that data to someone else who might also want us to try to buy something, right? But let's say, might you discover on Wednesday, if you go through this process, let's say you've looked for, some sort of adult entertainment and that had been tracked by these companies and they sold that information. Might you find that?
I think so. I personally don't
you're not worried
examine
about that.
The privacy policies of some of those places, so I couldn't tell you for sure.
Okay. Well, Facebook in particular is gearing up for a fight with California over these new standards. Why?
Facebook itself, I think, will say they support this law. And I think up until a certain point, they kind of didn't. They wanted some changes. I think they got them. But now they're saying they support it. So the way Facebook operates is it doesn't really buy or sell your data, actually, but they have a web trackers. One of them is called Pixel. And if you're a business, you can put for free Facebook's Pixel on your site. The consumer doesn't see it. It's not really visible. But behind that, it can look at your behavior on the website, and Facebook knows who you are because it has your Facebook profile, and then it can kind of take your behavior on the site to get more data about you. And then the business can get, you know, analytics through that for themselves, and they can buy ads on Facebook based on that data. So that's not really selling data. The business doesn't know what Facebook knows about you. It's a sort of a one-way transfer. The sale comes from the ads based on the data. So depending on how you want to interpret the law and the words and what it means, Facebook could say, we're not buying it, we're not selling it. So, you know, it's up to the business site that this is on to follow any applicable laws. We're just doing a service. This is a business purpose, which is an exemption that the law has.
Well, we'll see how California's attorney general and, you know, how this legal battle unfolds. But in the meantime, this opt-out that consumers have, do consumers stand to lose anything if they say, I don't want you to do this?
So the law says there's a right to non-discrimination, so websites can't give you a different or lesser service because you don't want your data to be sold. But a lot of these sites are free because they make money somehow, and that money is generally the data that you provide them. So it wouldn't be unrealistic to think that if that economy suddenly can't make that much money, there might be some changes there. But no, a site can't just say, you didn't want us to sell your data, so we give you, you know, half the service or you got to go.
Peanuts for you.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see how this unfolds. Sarah Morrison, a reporter for Recode. And again, starting the first of the year, Wednesday, the California Consumer Privacy Act goes into effect. And it's, of course, expected to affect people across the country. So watch out for that. Sarah, thank you.
Sure, thanks.
So, Jeremy, will you opt out?
Tell me. Yes, and yes. Yeah. And by the way,
yeah?
This just reminds me, 20 years ago right now, Robin, was the eve of Y2K. We see how that turned out.
Okay, well, think about that. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. That was so scary. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Astrology has been around for millennia, but right now many are seeing a resurgence, especially among young people.
We're trying to clarify our purpose and understand what are the biggest emergencies to tend to. And people really need to know, is there some reason for this?
A sign of the times, next time on Here and Now.